Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
As a black man, as a former player, I think it's best for me to support the players and just not be here tonight.
Sports comes to a screeching halt over racial injustice. Major League players unite in an unprecedented strike over the police shooting of Jacob Blake, and I speak with sports journalist Howard Bryant. And at the Republican convention, the grand old party takes a page from Richard Nixon's divide and rule, law and order playbook. I asked the Trump campaign whether this will be their strategy for November. Then, will President Trump's evangelical base rally behind his message again? I'll ask religious scholar and author Robert P. Jones. Plus,
there's still no doubt, even today, among Trump's sitting senior officials that the Russians interfered in 2016 in our election with the aim of advantaging Donald Trump.
UN ambassador and national security advisor for President Obama, Susan Rice, tells our Walter Isaacson the Russians are coming again. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. From women's and men's basketball to Major League Soccer and baseball games, professional players across the United States walked out in protest over the shooting of Jacob Blake. Exactly 4 years ago this week, NFL superstar Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the national anthem, an act of peaceful protest against police shootings that he says cost him his career with the league. Today, the uprising for racial justice has developed into a tsunami, with black and white alike demanding change. And while the NBA players have now agreed to resume the playoffs by the weekend, the history of black athletes and protest is long and storied. ESPN columnist Howard Bryant joins me now for more. He's author of The Heritage, Black Athletes Who Divided America and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard Bryant, welcome back to our program. Given the fact that the NBA are agreeing to go back, let's just take what happened when they decided to walk out and then triggered essentially a flood of other sports people doing the same. What were your thoughts when that happened?
Well, I think my initial thought was it took me back to 2014 when we were in almost this exact same position with the Donald Sterling scandal, when the Los Angeles Clippers had said that they were thinking about boycotting the playoffs then, but cooler heads prevailed and there was diplomacy between Adam Silver, the new commissioner who had been on the job 3 weeks, and the players decided to protest, but they decided not to quit playing. Then the same thing happened earlier this year after the death of George Floyd, where there was a faction of players who had said, maybe basketball's irrelevant right now. Maybe this is not quite the time to go out and entertain the public, and yet the public and yet the players still went out to play. But yesterday was different. This was the moment where the players had decided that it was disadvantageous to them to go out and entertain the public when something like this continues to go on. It was a remarkable moment.
Indeed, and I mean, it really electrified America precisely because of what sports means to America. And of course, so many of these sports are successful because of their black players, whether it's the WNBA, we've seen Naomi Osaka did it, and others followed. Why do you think, and can you tell us exactly what's going on now? Why do you think the NBA decided to go back?
Well, I think that at the end of the day, they're professionals. And I think this is their livelihood. This is what they do. And I think they have a professional responsibility to each other and also to the people who pay them and also to the fans who watch them. I think at the end of the day, the level of professionalism that you see with these athletes is extremely high. I think you also see, however, the levels of pain that they're feeling. And the fact that it wasn't just one moment, it was a coordinated effort from the NBA to the WNBA, and then even baseball at 7.7% African-American, that baseball teams walked out as well. You had three games that were canceled there as well. I think that what they've recognized is that they made a statement. They wanted that statement to be heard. They wanted it to be felt. And then I think they are perfectly willing to work within the system. But let's also not forget, Christian, that there was a faction of players that really did not want to play earlier. So I think that this is it's going to be very interesting to see what happens when football starts up. And I don't think that this is the last that we've seen mm-hmm. of this sort of wildcat approach to protest.
You know, the question really is, what does it all mean? I mean, none other than President Obama tweeted support for the Milwaukee Bucks, who started this NBA stream anyway. He said yesterday, "I commend the players of the Bucks for standing up for what they believe in. Coaches like Doc Rivers and the NBA and WNBA for setting an example. It's going to take all our institutions to stand up for our values." You know, that's what I want to ask you about, because you've followed this for so long, plus the history of black protest, black athletes protesting. I mean, I recall the pictures of the athletes at the 1968 or 1960 Olympics in Mexico. And of course, we all know about what happened in South Africa during apartheid, where athletes from all over the world boycotted playing against South African teams. Just put it in context and what you think this, let's face it, fairly temporary walkout in America overnight might achieve.
Well, I think the most important thing when you're thinking about this heritage, this list of this legacy of protest, is risk. Taking a risk, getting involved, realizing that something is bigger than you, and also the fact that you represent something that does have a historical legacy. That if there's one thing in the United States that we understand, it's money. We understand that we listen to people who have the money. And the players right now are enormously wealthy. They're the most visible and most successful and most accessible black employees in this country. And people pay attention to what they say. And I think that after you had this 40 or almost 50 year silence between the Muhammad Ali's and the Tommy Smith and the John Carlos's from the 68 Olympics, you suddenly have a revival. And this generation is taking that revival seriously. And let's also not forget that unlike previous administrations, the federal government, the White House, has made it very, very clear that part of their political strategy is demonizing these black athletes. So at a time where you have players coming out, WNBA, NBA players coming out saying that they are feeling what's happening in this country very profoundly, you also have a Republican National Committee, a convention taking place right now where they're doubling down on law enforcement. So there's a collision here. There's no question that it feels like this country is falling apart. And the athletes are in the center of it in a way that they haven't been really in a half century.
And we're going to dig deep into the convention politics in a second. But just before I let you go, I want to pick up on something you said. You know, sometimes they're demonized for doing this because they're rich, because they have privilege and, you know, perhaps they can afford to take a day off or so. That's exactly what Jared Kushner said about the players when he was asked about this kind of wildcat walkout. Listen to what he said.
Look, I think that the NBA players are very fortunate that they have the financial position where they're able to take a night off from work without having to have the consequences to themselves financially. So they have that luxury, which is great.
That's exactly the demonizing that you have in sports, where people want you to be grateful. Be grateful for what you have. This is exactly the point. You have the power, the financial power, to actually do this. This is what everyone wants. Who doesn't want self-determination? The players actually do have the sort of leverage. This is what they've been fighting for the last 65 years, is to have the financial freedom and to have the self-determination to be able to have power. Otherwise, they're completely and always under the thumb of ownership. I actually think that their wealth gives them the opportunity to be something more than that. That's what everybody wants.
And finally, Jared Kushner also was asked about LeBron James, and he said he would reach out to him. And obviously, LeBron James has been very prominent in his social activism and the money he donates and tries to help with this cause. Can you see anything coming out of a call or a meeting of, I don't know, agendas between the White House and LeBron James?
No, I think it's all performative. And I think that I think this is triage in a lot of ways on the part of the White House. I think that what you're going to see right now is, after this convention, you're going to see the same playbook that we saw in 2016, where the black athletes become they become the symbol of division in terms of where the White House sort of devotes their energy to get that base all upset at black players, just as he did in 2016.
Howard Bryant, thank you so much for joining us. And we are going to discuss more of this in a moment, because now Jacob Blake was shot 7 times in the back as he entered a car where his children were seated in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The officer who shot him is being placed on administrative leave, and a 17-year-old described as a white vigilante from out of state is jailed and charged with homicide after 2 people were killed at demonstrations on Tuesday. And the political fallout was on display in Vice President Mike Pence's convention speech, which was delivered before the president accepted his party's nomination. Pence included this dark vision.
Joe Biden would double down on the very policies that are leading to violence in America's cities. The hard truth is, you won't be safe in Joe Biden's America.
So is this the Republican Party's rallying cry for November? To answer that, I'm joined by Ken Blackwell. He's Ohio's former Secretary of State, and he's an advisor to the Trump campaign, joining us now from Cincinnati. Ken Blackwell, welcome to the program. Can I just ask you to react, given all that we've been talking about and this very fraught moment and genuine pain on the streets? The vice president basically declaring that nobody will be safe in Joe Biden's America. Isn't that just pure fear-mongering?
No, it isn't. I think let's take a look at what you just said in your last interview about the black athletes and their concern and their speaking out against what they perceive to be a wrongful use of force. And the injuring in this case of a black citizen. Look, at the end of the day, this is not about defunding the police. It's about how do you create safe neighborhoods and safe streets for people to raise their families. That is so true. I'm a former mayor, so I understand. I in fact provided local oversight, citizen oversight to the Cincinnati Police Department. We were very transparent when it came to the wrongful use of force, and we held people accountable. We didn't talk about defunding the police department in categorical terms. Mm-hmm. You know, this is crazy. If you take a look at what's happening in Chicago, what's happening in Detroit, what's happening in New York, if you talk about homicides and you talk about protecting innocent life, you need trained, compassionate police forces that are held accountable.
But isn't that the point?
Mm-hmm. Isn't that the point?
The point is
that there are more deaths. If you take a look at it, look at the hard numbers. Look at the hard numbers, and then also look at the reaction of the Trump administration. They, through their Operation Legend, said, look, we will in fact help to coordinate safety forces across jurisdictions to make sure the streets are safe and neighborhoods are safe. We will also hold accountable those folks who use force unlawfully that not only result in injury, but result in death. So people are starting to speak past that. You know, what irritates me, and I'm going to tell you, what irritates me as a black man who's been a mayor of a city, who's been an undersecretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, is when I don't hear this concern about the cities that are becoming killing fields with blacks killing blacks in much greater numbers than the wrongful use of force.
Mr. Blackwell, look. Nobody, including your party, accuses Joe Biden of wanting to defund the police. As you know, he also believes that that's a crazy idea. He does not believe in that, nor does his running mate, nor do his close political allies. And he has said burning down communities is not protest. Mr. Blackwell, you might not buy it, but he said it.
He doesn't buy it. He in fact, there's a party platform. They talk about reimagining. They talk about diverting funds. What you need are safety forces that are well-trained, and we have them across this country. Do you have bad apples?
Yes.
Do you have incidents? where there's a wrongful use of force, yes, those folks should be punished. They should be weeded out. And in fact, we should move and look at alternative ways of resolving incidents. There's agreement on
okay.
that. There's agreement on that.
Okay. So he's also condemned, Mr. Blackwell. He's also condemned.
We need to stop creating.
He's also condemned.
We need to stop.
That's right. And the nominee for the Democratic Party has condemned lawlessness.
It took Joe Biden until yesterday to speak out against the urban violence. It took him until yesterday. So what kind of leadership is that?
Okay. Do you not accept? I mean, do you not accept what we've seen unfold in front of our very eyes and on global television, certainly over the last several months since the killing of George Floyd, that the protests, and I'm now talking about the peaceful protests, have erupted each time a black man, an unarmed black man, is killed by police? I mean, do you accept that?
No, what I accept is that in the case of George Floyd, the Justice Department, the President of the United States, and both parties of the United States Senate said we must establish transparency. We must, in fact, have a procedure that will help us weed out bad actors, and we must bring charges against those police officers that killed that citizen. Mm-hmm. Period. That's what happened.
Okay.
There is no justification.
Okay.
In the destruction of property, the taking of lives, and creating an environment where what's happening? What's happening is that you're going to run capital and net taxpayers out of your cities, and you're going to create cities where violence prevails. And guess who is most hurt by that violence? Minorities and low
okay.
income.
I need to ask you two more things. Yep.
Yeah.
I just need to ask you, because I'm talking to you about the Republican convention and in your capacity as an advisor to the campaign. So actually mm-hmm. what I'm trying to figure out is, given what we've heard from the stage at the convention, is this party right now seeing a way to victory through a law and order platform, as we saw what Richard Nixon did, as we saw what George H.W. Bush did in 1988. And the reason I'm asking you this is because a lot of analysts are suggesting that this summer is providing a campaign vehicle for the party.
This is not a strategic response to a campaign objective. This is speaking to what we know, that the United States is the most diverse, the most prosperous constitutional republic, because it is established on the rule of law. We don't profess to be perfect, but we know that as we provide effort to become a more perfect union, we in fact do it by good men and good women doing great things together, not by big government that tends to strangle individual liberty. You know, so, you know, this
okay,
nonsense,
let me ask you this question.
Let me just tell you, it is pure demagoguery to suggest that anybody that's concerned about creating safe neighborhoods and safe environments is talking about a political strategy. You know, is it a
okay, then I need
strategy?
To ask you that. I need to ask you to react
strategy,
to this then, Mr. Blackwell.
To the depths of thousands of black people in these urban cities that have become lawless deserts.
Your party brought to a major convention speech a couple who, as you know of them very well, who
That's
were
right.
carrying arms when peaceful protesters went by their house and they pointed their guns at those protesters. They were invited to speak at the convention.
How did the protesters get into a gate?
In any event, that's not my point. What I want to ask you...
Don't run this game. Don't try to run this game on me. How did those protesters...
I'm not running a game on you. I'm trying to ask you a question.
How did those protesters get into that community? How did they get into that community?
Okay.
And do I believe in the constitutional
To be honest
right,
with you, I have right no idea.
Property and to bear arms, to protect your life and your property? Yes, I do. Go ahead and say it. I want to ask you a question.
Board of
Directors for the National Rifle Association. I'm a strong defender of the Constitution and all of the individual rights articulated in that Constitution. You know.
Okay.
Look, I've done it.
I need to ask you my final question.
Of leading a city. I've held the responsibility of guarding the state treasure and assets of the state of Ohio. I've run for election and I've gotten substantial black votes, but that's because I don't play this game of subtraction and division. This is,
all right,
as far as I'm concerned, e pluribus unum. We can be one from many. And I don't play the game of division. And that's what so many on the left like.
Okay.
They like division.
Okay. Right. Mr. Blackwell, you know what? I tried to have a conversation. It hasn't quite been a conversation. It's hard with this technology. We'll try it again another time. Now,
yes, ma'am.
The Republican Party sees a path to electoral college through the suburbs, and it's targeting a narrow coalition of voters who pushed the president over the top in 2016, a group that's whiter, older, and more evangelical than much of America. But according to my next guest, it's a strategy that simply isn't sustainable. At best, it could pay off in the short term. Robert P. Jones, who's a religion scholar and founder of the nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute, is also the author of White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And he's joining us now from Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Jones. I want to ask you to follow up. Maybe you heard a little bit of what Mr. Blackwell was saying. I'll ask you in a second. But I just want to start by asking you, given what we're seeing, given the, as we've called it, sort of the storm of protest, this summer of discontent, what we're seeing from the stage at the convention and what's really happening on the streets, where do you think the voters who you study, the evangelicals, where do you think they're going this time around compared to last time?
All right. Well, thanks for having me. You know, I think it's important to realize that certainly white evangelicals were sort of Trump's base, and they voted for him 81%. But I think what's maybe surprising and people haven't quite recognized is that it's actually white Christians across the board, not just white evangelicals that are heavily in the South. But in 2016, for example, white evangelicals voted for him 81%. White mainline Protestants, even the more progressive or liberal end of the white Protestant world, voted for him 57%, and white Catholics voted for him nearly 2/3. So it is sort of kind of white Christians across the board in President Trump's base that I think are supportive of him. And what we're seeing is a little bit of fracturing, actually, in that base. On the one hand, we're seeing no movement to speak of among white evangelicals. So they're still approximately 2/3 in favor of him. But we have seen some drop, some real volatility among white mainline Protestant voters, and also some real volatility and even decline in favorability ratings for the president among white Catholics. Now, that group is significant for two reasons. One, Joe Biden himself is a white Catholic. And then sort of tactically or strategically speaking, white Catholics and white mainline Protestants are actually as big or bigger constituencies in the key upper Midwest states where the election is really going to be won or lost in the Electoral College.
So what are you doing? You're painting a picture of some instability, or we can't take for granted that vote that put him over the top in 2016?
Well, you know, I think the way you put it earlier is right. You know, we are at this tipping point in the country, you know, and we have really passed from being a country that was majority white and Christian, demographically speaking, just back as recently as 2008 when Barack Obama was running for president. The country was 54% white and Christian. Today, that number is 44%. And so, you know, even if you look at evangelicals, his strongest base, you know, back 4 years ago, they were 17% of the country. Today, they're 15% of the country. So even if he got every last vote that he got from white Christian voters, I mean, in 2016, there are less of them as a proportion of the population than there were even 4 years ago.
Okay, that's fascinating, because presumably a lot of them also make up this famous suburban vote that the president and both parties are going for, frankly. You've heard I tried to ask a campaign advisor to President Trump about the strategy, about the suburban strategy, and about the law and order card that seems to be played right now. And I mentioned the couple who were brought to a prominent speaking position at the convention who had, you know, raised their guns and you know, during peaceful protests a while ago. I want to play a little mashup of them and what some have said about this issue, and then I'll get you to respond.
They're not satisfied with spreading the chaos and violence into our communities. They want to abolish the suburbs altogether.
It's almost like this election is shaping up to be church, work, and school versus rioting, looting, and vandalism.
It's a horror film, really. They'll disarm you, empty the prisons, lock you in your home, and invite MS-13 to live next door.
I mean, obviously, some of those claims are outlandish. What do you make of it, though, as a political strategy? Do you think that it is being used as a strategy like Nixon did?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, if you really pay attention to the patterns here, I mean, even before the convention, you know, Trump was talking about tweeting. Actually, in one tweet, right, he had this claim about the suburbs being destroyed. They were going to be invaded by low-income housing. And then he tagged an African-American politician, Cory Booker, as the one who was going to be responsible for this. You know, so right there in one, you know, 160-character tweet, you really have what can only be called really a white supremacist appeal to fear. And so the other thing you have to pay attention to is whenever you hear the word "you," right? You can never be, you're not going to be safe in Joe Biden's America. It's worth interrogating. Well, who is that you, right? Do African-Americans think that? Do Latinos think that? No, I mean, really, that's an appeal, as you say, really to this white suburban voter. And the reason you're hearing the word suburbs overall is because he is losing. In 2018, there was kind of pullback in the midterm elections among white suburban voters. We're seeing that in favorability as well. And I think there's a real concern there that there's a weakness, but there is this appeal, and it's straight out of Nixon. He's just dusted off Nixon's law and order playbook. This is not new, though. I mean, if we remember, even in 2016, it's worth noting that the opening night of the 2016 Republican National Convention, the theme was "Make America Safe Again," right? So this has been a drum that President Trump has been beating for quite a while, but I think he's been picked up the intensity of it strategically for this moment. But it really is, you know, only thinly veiled, you know, appeal to kind of racial fears to whites.
So let me then take a little bit out of your book on this issue. "White Too Long" is the title, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And obviously it examines how the church has sustained and protected essentially white supremacy, you say. Here's a quote from you. "White Christian churches have not just been complacent, they have not only been complicit. Rather, as the dominant cultural power in America, they have been responsible for constructing and sustaining a project to protect white supremacy and resist black equality." And you say they've done this by dressing up white supremacy in theological garb and giving it a home in a respected institution. You know, that's a pretty heavy indictment, and I'm sure they would thoroughly disagree with what they believe is a, you know, their Christian spirit. How did you come to that conclusion?
Right. Well, you know, it's been a very long journey for me, to be honest. I mean, you know, the book is a personal one. I grew up Southern Baptist in Jackson, Mississippi. I have a degree from a Southern Baptist college and a Southern Baptist seminary, and then a degree in religion. And even with all of that, you know, it really wasn't until I was an adult that I really understood the history of the country, and particularly white Christianity and the role that it played. Like, you know, everyone, When you hear like church and civil rights, everyone thinks of the African-American churches who served as a hub for organizing for civil rights. But what has really escaped attention is the very central role that white Christian churches played in resisting civil rights, in propping up segregation in the country. You know, just you can the examples you can multiply from politicians who like Ross Barnett from Mississippi, who was the very celebrated head of the men's Sunday school program at the most prominent church in Mississippi, First Baptist Church, who would on the stump say God was the original segregationist, would absolutely just say that in a declarative sentence. Mm-hmm. That was a regular part of his stump speech. It was absolutely celebrated and upheld. There was no pushback at all among the church, in Mississippi. And, you know, and that continues with us today. Another thing I would say is that the second point is that the proof is really in the pudding. I mean, one of the other the key parts of the book is really looking at contemporary public opinion data on a whole range of issues, from Confederate monuments and flags to police killing of African-American men by police. And on this issue you've been talking about here, the data is exceptionally clear. When you look at whites who identify as Christian and you compare them to whites who do not identify as Christian, there is this massive gap in attitudes on being willing to admit or see systemic injustice. So, for example, on the killing of African-American men by police, twice as many whites who are Christian compared to those who are not say these are just isolated incidents. They do not see the connections, whereas those who are whites who are not Christian are much more likely to say that these are part of a pattern of how African-Americans are treated by police. I can multiply, again, examples. In the book, I take over 15 different questions, again, ranging from those questions to Confederate monuments. And you see this gap in every single question. So this history, really, of being on the side of segregation, really thinking that whites, and particularly white Christians, were kind of meant by God to be at the top of the social pyramid. This was the normative Christian teaching in America for most of our history. It's only very recently, been changed. That legacy, even after those overt statements could no longer be said in public, you still see that, in Christian attitudes today.
So, okay, that's really interesting because you just mentioned the idea of bad apples versus systemic racism. And you heard my previous guest, Mr. Blackwell, talk about bad apples. And you hear from the Republican Convention that there is no systemic racism in the United States, whereby so many, I mean, there's huge polling that now believes it does exist and needs to be confronted. So in your book, you also talk about I think it's called the white Christian shuffle. You say when it comes to acknowledging or trying to deal with a historical legacy of racism, they engage in that. What does that mean exactly?
You know, it just comes from studying rhetoric and looking at even places where I think in more recent times, since like the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, where people have tried to reckon with this very difficult history. But what inevitably happens is that, white theologians, white Christian leaders try to take some steps and they'll admit, they'll apologize, all of that. But when it comes to the question of justice or repair and actually doing something about the damage, you quickly see this little two-step where it's kind of two-step forwards and at least one step, if not two, back when the rubber really hits the road and when the question of justice and repairing the damage that's been done over centuries really comes up.
Let me ask you another question. I tried to ask Mr. Blackwell this because, in relation to the people who were on stage having brandished guns at protesters, yeah. You know what happened, obviously, in Kenosha, that an appeal went out to come and defend American values, come and defend yeah. Kenosha. And now there is a 17-year-old who's, charged with homicide for allegedly following that call, coming from out of state, and two people are dead. There is very real life danger to this kind of division and calling on people to defend American values. And you just said, well, for who? What American values? There seems to be mm-hmm. such a moment of confusion, and it leads to a 17-year-old getting caught up in this terrible, terrible mess.
Well, it's heartbreaking, and it just so unsettling, but I think it is a real lack of leadership and a lack of clarity, particularly on the part of President Trump on this. We just passed the 3-year anniversary of the white supremacists marching in Charlottesville, where they were, chanting neo-Nazi slogans, "Blood and soil," and "Jews will not replace us," and defending a statue of Robert E. Lee. But President Trump has doubled down on his support for Confederate monuments. He's refused to renounce it. He said there were fine people on both sides when it took him 48 hours to make a comment. And then that's what he said in 2017. And even last night, in the convention speech, I just find it unconscionable that Mike Pence, and he had this platform right? And instead of, you know, mentioning Jacob Blake, instead of mentioning the cause of the protest, or even making any mention of this, this white vigilante who killed two people, murdered them in cold blood, makes no mention of that at all, and pivots with these hardline law and order things, and even mentions tearing down statues is not free speech. We will have law and order. I mean, it is, you know, it's not even thinly veiled. I mean, it really is coming down on the side of white supremacists and then putting a Christian veneer on it at the end of the speech. And this is exactly this connection between white supremacy and Christianity in the country that I outline in the book.
So let me just play a soundbite from Kellyanne Conway, who was also on the platform, who's also obviously a senior advisor to President Trump. She says she's leaving the White House at the end of the month. But she talked about what she was sort of paraphrasing Democrats about this whole law and order thing and the protests in the street. Just listen to this, and I'll ask you a quick question to close.
He knows full stop, and I guess Mayor Pete knows full stop, that the more chaos and anarchy and vandalism and violence reigns, the better it is for the very clear choice on who's best on public safety and law and order.
So very quickly, Mr. Jones, she's basically saying, you know, that's going to be, that's the campaign slogan right now. Will it work, do you think, amongst the base?
You know, it's hard to know. I think this election is going to be enormously close. We have about 40% of the country that's dug in, I think, supporting President Trump no matter what, and will actually tell us that on public opinion surveys. I really hope that we'll have a different kind of conversation, on this very troubling issue going forward. I think we have to have this conversation, and it has to really be about what it is, not just about the results of something, but it has to be about the causes. So issues like police violence disproportionately affecting African Americans. This kind of question of racial justice has to be part of the conversation, going forward.
And it's certainly out there on the streets. Robert P. Jones, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now, almost unnoticed in the current moment, a damning bipartisan Senate intelligence report which details Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. And our next guest says that it's happening again. Susan Rice was National Security Advisor to President Obama and Ambassador to the United Nations. She tells our Walter Isaacson that this administration's reaction to Russian interference is hugely concerning and will add to the political divisions that we're seeing right now.
Thanks, Christian, and Ambassador Susan Rice, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Walter.
The Senate Intelligence Committee has just produced a bipartisan report, somewhat surprisingly. They've all agreed, whether it be Senator Burr and the Democrats, on Russian interference in the election 3.5 years ago. Do you think that report vindicates your view and those of others that the Russians intentionally meddled in our election and that Trump welcomed it?
There's no doubt. And no serious person who's looked at this issue from the various elements of our intelligence community to now the Senate and, of course, Mueller, could conclude otherwise. There's still no doubt, even today, among Trump's sitting senior officials that the Russians interfered in 2016 in our election with the aim of advantaging Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, we now know, both from the Mueller report, but in more detail in many ways from this new Republican-led Senate report, welcomed, encouraged, and benefited from that Russian assistance.
And do you think the Russians are going to be trying to do it again? And what are you particularly worried about?
Well, absolutely, they're going to do it again, and they already are. And our intelligence community a couple of weeks ago put out an updated warning, making it very clear that Russia is going to continue the similar tactics to what they employed in 2016. And Walter actually never stopped doing in the years since. So not only might they again try to intrude into our electoral systems and our databases and our voter registration rolls at the state level, but we also have to expect that they will continue to do what they have been doing, which is to pit Americans against each other, particularly on social media, exacerbating our divisions, whether on race or immigration or guns or gay rights, and trying to cause Americans to doubt each other, hate each other, and question the viability of our democratic institutions and the credibility of our vote. We also need to be concerned that Russia, yet again, it will be working to advantage Donald Trump, this time with Trump in power, having said very clearly that he welcomes that assistance, that he would never turn away a foreign offer of support. And indeed, he solicited that from Ukraine. He solicited it, you know, from the back lawn of the White House, from China, in broad daylight. And this is his modus operandi. And in the case of Russia, we saw from what we now learned in 2016 that there was active communication, coordination between elements associated with Russian intelligence and the Trump family and the Trump campaign. So this is very worrisome. And now in 2020, there's an added element. And that added element, Walter, is that there are now members of the United States Senate on the Republican side, people like Senator Ron Johnson, who are running sham investigations in quotations, taking information provided them by Russian operatives and Russian-backed Ukrainian officials who are trying to discredit falsely Joe Biden to advantage Donald Trump. So it's not just now the Russians and the Trump campaign. It's also, in some instances, allies in the Senate.
What did you think when you watched the video of Jacob Blake, the latest African-American to be shot by police, after we've seen all the videos this year?
I just felt despair and despondency and anger and just amazement. He was walking with his back to the police to get in his own car with his three kids, and he was grabbed and shot repeatedly in the back. Why? Why? It's so horrific, and it just happens all too often. And you would think that after all that transpired following George Floyd's murder, that some cop in a neighboring state might think twice before he pops off in broad daylight on somebody who posed absolutely no threat. But he doesn't. And so that tells you just how profoundly problematic our society is, and how, you know, policing in this country still bears little, if any, regard for Black lives.
What do you think should be done about this? And do you worry that a slogan like defund the police might distract from what really needs to be done?
Yes. What needs to be done at a minimum is for the Senate to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which was passed early and broadly by the House of Representatives. And it has languished in the Senate because Mitch McConnell, as is so often the case, doesn't want to do the right thing. And Donald Trump has absolutely no interest in seeing legislation that is fair, that is rational, that is balanced pass. But obviously that's a step that is necessary, but it's not sufficient. I do not favor defunding the police. If defunding the police means cutting all resources to police departments or dramatically slashing budgets, I think we cannot have a one-size-fits-all approach to this. There's some communities where policing is underfunded. There's some communities where it's overfunded. There's some communities where a rational reallocation of the resources that are earmarked for police would make great sense. I think we can reimagine the role of policing. I think we need to get police out of doing social work. I think we need to invest more in our communities and get at many of the underlying disparities that are causing so much suffering on a daily basis, from housing to education to health issues. I think all of that's the case, but this slogan of so-called defunding the police is very predictably being hijacked by opponents of any sort of progress on racial justice as a way of dividing the majority of Americans who believe that it is long past time that there be more fairness and justice in our criminal justice system, but also in our society writ large.
You talk about those political divisions in your book, and you say that they are a national security issue. Explain why.
Our divisions are preventing us from getting basic, necessary things done. So we can't fix the problems with the Postal Service or deal with our infrastructure or pass important legislation like the Justice and Policing Act, because, you know, Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump will resist finding common ground. And there are areas where, you know, the Democrats may need to compromise, and they haven't. Our divisions are preventing us from doing very fundamental things that are necessary for us to be effective, to be strong, and to compete internationally. So that's the first way in which our divisions are crippling us in a very fundamental way. And we can't be strong and effective on the global stage when we're so debilitated domestically. But the second way that they are a vulnerability is what we were discussing with respect to Russia, where adversaries like Russia, or especially Russia, recognize that they can weaken us as a rival on the global stage. They can discredit democracy, which is something that they have every interest in doing, without ever firing a bullet, if they can exacerbate our domestic political divisions and cause us to turn on one another by promoting lies and truths, even on social media, on both sides of every divisive issue, trying to get Americans to fear and hate each other and turn on each other. And if Russia or other adversaries can do that effectively, then they're in a far better position relative to the United States. And it's a very cheap and easy way to bring us down.
Last year, you wrote a really powerful, poignant, very personal book called Tough Love. And in it, among the things you warned us about was a possible pandemic coming. Now the book is out in paperback this week, and you've written a new afterwards talking about the pandemic response. Give me your take on that.
Walter, the extraordinary thing is, despite what President Trump said, which is that no one could have ever predicted anything like this, experts, national security experts, global health experts, including myself, we all predicted a pandemic. We knew it was inevitable. The only thing we didn't know was precisely when it would occur and what form it would take. And that's why we left a 69-page playbook, which I like to refer to as Pandemics for Dummies. That's why we ran a tabletop exercise with all of Trump's incoming cabinet and put together briefing materials and oral briefings to alert them to this possibility and give them a running start as to how to respond. But what Trump did every step of the way, Walter, is to prioritize his own personal political interest over the health and well-being of the American people and the viability of our economy. Going back to early January, when we first got word that there was a new coronavirus emerging in China, the president began by downplaying its significance, saying it was like the seasonal flu, it would go away, it was no big deal. He refused to put in place swiftly and effectively the testing mechanisms that we needed to get ahead of this, and we still don't have adequate testing. He didn't use the power of the federal government to ensure that we had adequate personal protective equipment and ventilators and healthcare workers and beds properly distributed, and then use that power of the government to ensure that states weren't competing against each other on the open market, driving up the price for scarce goods. He shut down the economy in March, which was the right thing to do, although a little bit late, and yet reopened it way prematurely, long before many states had adequately bent the curve of the virus. And then in the early reopening, he accelerated another wave, which we've now been experiencing over this summer. And, our economy is continuing to suffer. We have nearly 180,000 Americans dead and counting, over 5 million infections. We are the worst country in the world in terms of the death rate and absolute numbers. It's just appalling. And it didn't have to be this way.
But the president says a lot of his actions, like the ban on travel from China, helped save lives. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, Walter, diseases don't respect borders. And you cannot keep out a virus like the coronavirus, as has been demonstrated. He shut the borders travel from China imperfectly, partially in January. after some 20 other countries had done so. And 400,000 or so people traveled from China to the United States between December and March. So one, it wasn't a perfect shutdown, and it can't be because we have US citizens and green card holders and others that need to come back and forth. But secondly, you know, the virus was already here. And look at what happened in the East Coast in New York and up and down the Eastern Seaboard. The virus arrived from Europe and devastated the East Coast. So, and then President Trump also likes to tout that in March, he belatedly cut off travel from Europe. I'm not saying that there's no utility in limiting travel. I'm saying that it is false and misleading to claim that that step alone saved millions of lives. That is, there's nothing to support that and evidence the fact that we here in the United States are suffering the worst outcomes from coronavirus because of Donald Trump's failed leadership. And what also that travel ban from China, I know it wasn't a ban, but the travel restrictions from China did was give both the administration, I believe, and Americans a false sense of security.
You were on Joe Biden's list for possible vice president. Would you serve in his administration in any capacity now?
Look, I will do, and I've been trying to do my utmost to help Joe Biden and Kamala Harris win the White House. And I also think it's vitally important that we flip the Senate to give them the backing that they need to be effective at a moment of crisis when we're trying to dig out. So that is my sole focus for the moment. And yes, if Joe Biden would like me to serve with him in some other capacity, I'm very open to that. And I would have that conversation with him. But let's win first and let him figure out what constellation of players and personnel he feels he needs in his senior leadership roles. And I will do my utmost to be helpful if that is what he wants. And if that's not what he wants, I'm fine with that too.
You talk about the ideological divisiveness, the poison partisanship happening in our country, but it also happens in families, as you know, because you write about it in Tough Love, your book, about your son, Jake, being very conservative and you having arguments. How do you deal with it in a family? And how do you think that's a metaphor for how we can deal with it as a country?
It's hard. I mean, there are moments where, you know, we all lose our cool. And my son in particular, perhaps, with each other. But at the end of the day, you know, we recognize that we are family. We only have each other first and foremost. And if we let that collapse, then we've lost, you know, a huge amount of who we are. And so we try to stay focused on the fact that what we have in common, our shared history, our values, our desire for the future, our desire to be a strong unitary family far outweighs those political differences. And my son and I are very close. I'm close to both my children. And one, you know, my daughter almost never gets on my nerves from a political point of view. My son does constantly, but we work through it. And I think that's what we have to do as a nation, Walter. You know, we are not a monolith. We can't be. That's not what makes us a vibrant democracy. But when we fail to be able to hear each other and see each other and care about what the others who may differ with us have to say, what their experiences are, then I think we're sunk. So the end of the day, like a family, as a country, we are all in this boat together and we sink or swim together. And I don't have patience for people on the far right or the far left who are ideological purists who think that, you know, it's somehow a weakness to be willing to engage with those with whom we differ. I think it's a strength. And I will never be convinced otherwise of that.
Ambassador Susan Rice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Walter.
And finally, hundreds of people walking through Washington, D.C.'s Union Station this week have paused to look at this giant mosaic honoring Ida B. Wells, a former slave and anti-lynching crusader who fearlessly fought for racial justice and women's suffrage in the 19th century. The mural was designed by artist Helen Marshall, and if you look closely, it's made up of thousands of images of suffragists. And tomorrow, we'll be discussing the magazine cover that has everyone talking right now with Vanity Fair editor Radhika Jones and guest editor Ta-Nehisi Coates. It is about immortalizing Breonna Taylor, the black woman who was killed by police in her home in Kentucky, still awaiting justice. That is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.